This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
And we're going to talk about what's new in the world of books and reading. Really, this is an excuse for this show for me to ask Rebecca a series of questions about two book covers I saw. And I hope to not take up the whole 45 minutes to an hour with it this week. I was traveling. Rebecca was traveling. I guess we can do some travel check-in. You were at PLA. You were actually doing real book things. I was just seeing book things in the wild while I was traveling. Let's see. I have to admit, I'm always excited to podcast you, Rebecca, so don't take this the wrong way. I wish we were doing the next thing we're going to do right now, which is talk about James by Percival Everett.
Me too, especially because I misread our spreadsheet of podcast scheduling earlier this month. So I read the book 2 weeks ago and did all my notes and then was like, oh, I don't get to talk to Jeff about it tomorrow. I have to wait.
We haven't texted each other. We've done none of this stuff.
We have not. We've stayed pure.
So if you are interested in that, that will be in the Patreon Tuesday, right? Is when that'll come out?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So really looking forward to that. We're going to get to that as well. Any kind of follow-up from there? I asked Sharifa to talk about something I wrote for the deep dive. I will return the favor and recommend Sharifa's, I think she teased it, saying that she read Rosemary's Baby shortly after giving birth to her twins, which I said at the time was some truly unhinged behavior, but also kind of amazing. So go check that on the deep dive as well if you're interested in that sort of content. Let's do a sponsor break because I think that's it for my follow-up. Yeah, okay.
Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you've probably never heard of. And bonus points because it's Finnish. And when's the last time you read a Finnish dystopian science fiction novel? Right. Okay. So in this one, humanity is destroying itself as the cities burn, which sounds kind of familiar. It is the time of the great affliction. In this terrible world, a new hope arises. The Happiness Program, which is the creation of Finnish pharmaceutical genius Dr. Laura Solomon. With happiness, pills, mind mapping, and microchips, Dr. Solomon intends to build a new world for the worthy few. Which sounds like a perfect plan and nothing could go wrong, right? Right. So this is a raw but fun dystopian sci-fi adventure with an unusual premise describing what happens when technology rules humanity. Either you're chipped living inside the AR society or you're left outside to barely survive. Make sure to check out Unchipped by Taya DeVere. And thanks again to Unchipped, the most epic dystopian science fiction adventure series that you probably never heard of, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Charming, easygoing, and rich, Xavier Castillo has the world at his fingertips. He also has no interest in taking over his family's empire, but that hasn't stopped women from throwing themselves at him. Unless, of course, the woman in question is his publicist. The cool, the intelligent, the ambitious Sloane Kensington, who is a high-powered publicist who's used to dealing with difficult clients, but none infuriate or tempt her more than a certain billionaire heir with his stupid dimples and laid-back attitude. She may be forced to work with him, but she'll never fall for him because he's a client and that's all he'll ever be, right? Right, girl, like we all know. So just in case you didn't know, author Anna Wong is the best-selling author and book talk viral author of the Twisted Love series, the King of Sin series. Miss Wong got it going on, okay? Make sure to check out King of Sloth by Anna Wong. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode.
You were in Columbus, Ohio to talk with clients, do represent BR from a, you know, just represent BR and talk to clients and advertising, some publicity stuff. Don't really know if there's any recappy stuff to do there. But for the general reader, did you, you sent me a text, which I was almost put on the Patreon with a picture of a book, but we tend not to like to mix up the haterade. So I guess I'll just do that as a tease and say there was that. Any trends, anything you noticed, anything that you think the general listener of the Book Riot podcast might find illuminative or interesting?
You know, so PLA, for folks who don't know, is the public professional librarians conference, not just public. And, it's typically set up where the publishers all have booths, publishers and library-facing businesses, a lot of tech companies that are selling things into libraries. They have booths and they are talking to librarians, trying to get those librarians to order their upcoming books to be part of the library's collection. I was expecting to see and hear a lot about romantasy because that's what's in the water right now. And especially as you were coming out of your run of like 20 meetings in New York and publishers were talking a lot about that. I didn't hear so much about romantasy this time around. Like there were a few publishers that were showing us that those were their big titles. I did notice something that would have just blown my mind if I had seen it at a convention when we started Book Riot, like back in 2011, 2012. And it's just, I mean, it's really wonderful. So encouraging. There are books by and about queer people and queer issues everywhere. There are books addressing race everywhere. And maybe this is publishers tailoring to what they know librarians are particularly interested in doing. Like being in a room, a big room with like thousands of librarians does give you the sense that like, I know these people are not a monolith, but also you can start to see like some commonalities across like the things they're interested in, the tote bags that are going quickly, that sort of thing. So just seeing the persistence and expansion of books that are addressing the big issues of the moment, the ways that our culture is changing, and the things that the folks on the far right are pushing back against, seeing publishers like rise up to that and continue to support librarians and their mission was really cool. That was great. And any industry people who are listening to this who have been to Book Expo but never been to a librarians conference, let me tell you, like, it will ruin you for any good time you thought you ever had in the Javits Center, which is like, it's a low bar. And like typically in Javits at BEA, it's like you're going to walk 7 miles before you find something you're willing to eat. A bottle of water is going to cost you $25 and you're going to like say, thank you. May I have another? PLA opened, the show floor opened at 3 o'clock on Wednesday afternoon. We were there like basically right then. And there were buffets, like literal buffets.
What?
Set out. Yes, Jeff. I didn't text you this because I just really didn't want you to be sad. Like in the main avenues of the floor, there were buffets with like charcuterie boards and glasses of wine. I saw people carrying around tiny party plates with cheesecake on them.
What?
And then
what are you talking about? Is this a Carnival Cruise Line? What are we doing?
They are rolling it out for the librarians. Librarians get treated well and they deserve it. Like no shade on this, but I was like, what universe have I fallen into? The next day, mid-morning, there was a coffee break with coffee carts got rolled out into those spots. And then in the afternoon, there was lemonade and cookies and iced tea and like a can of Diet Coke if that's what you wanted.
It's all I want, really, when it comes down to it in the afternoon.
Our sales director, Jan, and I were, you know, in between meetings, and he was having a like, oh, I need to get some water. Let's go find me something. And I was just like, wait, we don't have to walk a million miles to buy you a bottle of water. There just is a thing with free water. It was so humane for a convention experience. And I am glad to know the librarians are being treated better than just, you know, all of the like book media press and the booksellers. But if I were a bookseller toiling the way that booksellers toil for the wages that they make, and I knew the librarians were getting this treatment, I might be a little salty. Well,
maybe Maybe Winter Institute in those places are like, I've never been to one of those.
Maybe Winter Institute is fancier, the ones that are exclusively for booksellers. But that's honestly the thing that blew my mind, was like, what is going on? People are walking around with cheesecake and wine.
Well, A, that's fascinating to know. B, what an abdication of duty not to take some pics. I could have gotten an Instagram reel out of this.
I'm sorry. I didn't know you were on the mission at that point.
Well, I would have liked to have seen. I mean, even now, even talking to people now, when we're talking to people in person, there is a particular enduring enmity for BEA at the Javits Center. And I think, I don't think it was BEA really. I think the Javits Center, it just makes people angry. It's like all the bad things of an office building and the worst things of an airport combined somehow. Yeah.
That's right. It's just the Death Star experientially. It's not, nothing's happy when you're in Javits, for sure.
Nothing happy there. Print galleys. What's going on with that? You are, you're basically the Ralph Nader of print galleys. So I'm curious to see what you are thinking and observing about the existence of print galleys.
There were many galleys, but it didn't look like the heyday of BEA. I think publishers have really started to do the thing of, I saw tons of displays where there were two copies and they had a sticker on the front that said display copy, which is code for do not put your
keep
hot
your
little
mitts
hands on
off
this book.
This. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then there would be one or two titles that they would have a whole bunch of galleys of. There were a few author signings. That's not as big of a thing as it was at BEA, the author signing. There were some galleys, but it wasn't a huge thing. I also wasn't like on a galley mission because I am the Ralph Nader of galleys, but I picked up, my mom is reading a lot of, she's coming out of historical fiction. My mom is done with Lady Librarian Spies.
Oh,
in
really? She's done. She's checked out, huh? Okay.
Yeah. She was like, they've all become the same. And I was like, I preach, lady.
I wonder how indicative that could be. This happens, right? Like something is hot for a while and then you get enough.
Yeah, she just was like, they all started running together. So I looked for sort of like general fiction for my mom. I picked up some thrillers that my sister might have been into, took down titles of a few things that I downloaded for myself from Edelweiss later. The big exciting moment that we had was that one of the publishers has a Squishmallows book, and one of Jan's children had their eye on the Squishmallow book. And it was a like, dad,
dude,
don't come home without
Squishmallows
it.
Squishmallows have been big in our house. We had a Squishmallow book as an advertising client, and it performed exceptionally well.
I think it's the same book. Yeah,
it's the same book. So shouts to the Squishmallow folks out there. How about when you're talking to people, what's the mood? Were you know people upbeat?
The mood was
downbeat?
Good.
Where were you on the people you were talking
people
to?
Seemed pretty upbeat. I got bumped into a lot of librarians who are obviously following book banning coverage. Yeah. And so we got to have sort of a mutual admiration society for Book Riot's Kelly Jensen and all the work she's done reporting on that. The vibe seemed good. Folks, the librarians were excited. Lots of tote bags got handed out. Lots of tote bags got taken home. People were just stoked, I think, to be back together. PLA is every 2 years, which gives you enough time to get excited about going to a convention again. So I think that matters. Like, it felt fresh. The publishers were happy to be there. Apparently at one of the shows in the PLA in 2022, because I went in 2020. It was right before COVID really settled in.
That was in Nashville.
That was in Nashville. And apparently like the 2022 show, a bunch of people got sick. And so like this was everyone was happy that we were together.
They're eating buffets. If they're eating buffets, they're feeling great about that.
Right. They have, you know, seeded the mood to like, it's going to be probably pretty good because you started off with wine and cheesecake and then you just carried on through the weekend. There was lots of education, so I didn't sit in on any of that, but I walked by education sessions about, you know, some really broad stuff about, you know, building your collection. But I saw signs for like how to provide specific services to like the elderly population, how to do things around inclusion in your library. Just the breadth of things that librarians are working on is mind-blowing, and I am aware that I don't have the full scope of it still. But yeah, it seemed upbeat. I remember we've had a couple BEAs, you know, back in the like mid-aughts when ebooks were on the rise and everyone thought that that was going to be the end of publishing. And then we went a couple other rounds of like Borders died and is that the end of publishing? And then Penguin and Random House became PRH and is that the end of publishing? And there's nothing like that in the water right now that feels like publishing dooming itself. Didn't hear anything about AI, which I thought was interesting. I don't know if they had any education sessions around it, but I thought that I would probably hear something like that in a publishing space. But overall, it was like, it was a really nice experience. Folks were in good moods. They were excited to talk about books. The lists are interesting. It was nice. I'm glad that I went. The next one, I think, is in Minneapolis in 2026, which really sounds like the future.
I don't understand. What's, again, have as many conventions you want. I literally do not care. What's the difference between PLA and ALA? Like,
I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. That's fine. ALA being the American Library Association.
Yes, which is, and PLA is professional.
Which is a bad mamma jam, as I'm hearing. Like, it's a bigger kind of endeavor.
Yeah, that's a big convention. So I'm not sure PLA moves around when it does its thing every 2 years. So it's not like, you know, stuck in one region. I do not know the differences. My impression is that a lot of folks are members of both. And since we were there to talk to publishers and not really facing librarians, I have to admit I didn't do the homework.
I just wondered if you could tell. Yeah, the amateur library association meeting would be interesting.
That would be a party. Yeah, probably the snacks are probably not as exciting.
Well, you know. There's a DIY element to that.
Somebody's making Alice and Roman's dip.
Yeah, there's going to be, it's not going to be up to code. I could tell you that right, now. Yeah. All right. Well, that's cool. Let me tell you a little bit. I did some traveling.
Please.
And I was, you know, looking around, went to some bookstores, and I'm going to keep the bookstore anonymous in the following discussion because there's some things I don't understand. I don't want to get anybody in trouble.
Okay.
That's what I'm not here. I'm not here for that. And I posted on the Patreon, which was free to everyone. I made it if you were just interested. I'll put a link in the show notes there of two pictures I took side by side of Kristen Hannah's The Women at a store that I visited of late. And one is the American hardcover edition. And Kristen Hannah now, and I don't know how long it's been this way, but for several books, she has her own aesthetic. And that's how you know you've made it.
Yes.
Right? It's like...
Yeah.
You have all this
your
gold
book covers
thing,
look the
it's the same font, and there's this sort of jewel-toned background. Did I use that right? Sometimes I try stuff out and you never know. A jewel-toned background, and it's her name bigger in the title below, and then some sort of embossed, sort of foggy, misty silhouette image. On the right-hand side, there was the UK cover for the Kristen Hannah. And I've got about five things I noticed about this. And I guess I'll start with the most interesting one to me. And you may not be able to tell from the picture, which is this was an American bookstore. And this were both of these were in the store. And they were selling the UK paperback.
That was going to be my question. Was this a used copy?
No. No, they were $24 for a paperback, for starters.
Interesting.
And they were in the same store. They weren't next to each other. And I almost wanted to ask somebody.
Yeah.
Like, what the... I guess my first question is, have you ever heard of this or seen this?
No. I've only bumped into foreign editions in used bookstores where, you know, they made their way there because somebody went to England and picked things up at Waterston's and brought them back. I've never been in a new bookstore in the U.S., that was selling a UK edition, much less alongside the US edition.
Yes. And it wasn't just someone had one copy. I thought, well, maybe they had one, they brought it back.
Weird.
And there was a stack of them there, which I thought was odd. And I was like, well, that's weird. Maybe it's a one-off or a mistake. But, and I guess I'll do this at some point. There was one for James too. There was the UK version of James in the same bookstore.
What does the UK cover of James look like?
I'll put on the Patreon later. I can't describe it. I'm a bad... It's quite different, I should say. It's quite different. So I was quite confused about this and spent a lot of time verbalizing it to my family, which I think they found as tedious as one can imagine, because my kids, as you might imagine, they are good spirits and interested in many things above and beyond their age. But the territory rights to the same book, and me speculating about what I don't know, is fascinating, because I would imagine, A, I've never seen this before, and B, I think the point of, I'll use James, because I don't actually know who the UK publisher of, I'm not looking at it right now. Macmillan is the publisher of James in the UK, mm-hmm. right? And isn't the point of Knopf Doubleday Random House, I think, is it a Doubleday book or Knopf? I mm-hmm. can't remember. I think the point of them giving Percival mid six figures as was rumored is so they got to sell the copies of James in the United States, Rebecca. Yes. Is not that the point yes. of that?
It was Doubleday. I just checked the spine Doubleday. On my desk. And
yeah,
yes.
I knew it was in that group, but I couldn't remember which.
Yeah, you make that investment because you think you're going to reap the payoff.
So my sense of this is that you're not supposed to be doing this.
Yeah, I think this is highly unusual. My generous reading would be somehow they accidentally ordered the wrong ISBN.
Okay. One is the best-selling book in the country, and the other is the most anticipated. Oops.
Oopsie. Yeah, that makes it seem less likely right. that it was a mistake. But it does happen. Like, sometimes in Edelweiss, I will run into the UK edition of something and not realize, like, especially if the covers are the same, that the thing I'm looking at is the UK edition, until I notice that, like, the publication date is wrong or something else is going on there. Really interesting. The distinctions between these two book covers, now that I'm just sitting here staring at it, are really interesting as well.
Yeah, so for those of you who haven't seen it, go look it up on the link in the show notes. But for the design, people always like, there's people that used to buy from the Book Depository here in the States because they'd like the UK or international version better. I put this on Facebook just to say, which do you like better? It was pretty evenly split. I have to say, I think it's overblown that the UK book covers are better. I think there's a grass is always greener. I think it's 50-50. Probably half the time I prefer, and that makes sense. If they don't know what they're doing, not they don't know what they're doing, but like if it's more about taste than anything else, it would make sense that it's about the same. I think what's striking to me is, I guess I had in the back of my mind, but I had forgotten that I knew that Kristen Hannah has now entered into the this is what her book's like place, which I think is both a place many people would love to get, but it also does the thing of, I just don't love this. I prefer the book to have mm-hmm. a different cover and a different vibe from book to book. And that's, I guess, in literary fiction, upmarket literary fiction, where I tend to do most of my leisure reading, it's just not as much of a thing to do this, right? This is borders on grocery store hits, which to sell the number of copies she is doing, it is a thing, because you want people that want to buy that book not to be freaked out or to be confused about what they're buying. If they're going to buy a million copies of them, just let it look like kind of like the last one did.
Yeah, you want your grande mocha to look the way your grande mocha last Starbucks that you went into. Yeah, and you're right. It doesn't happen in literary work much, except for like series or books that are follow-ons to things. Yeah. Like, you know, the Gilead books did all get redesigned and reissued to have similar covers, which I didn't love. Like, I actually, my set is mismatched and I'm fine with it. Mm-hmm. It's not my favorite thing. In a series, it really makes sense to me. Like the Colson Whitehead Harlem series, like those three, those covers are going to look similar. That's fine. But I don't care that much. Like, it would never even occur to me to order a book from the Book Depository to get a better cover. This is just not a thing that I care about much. But the fact that the women is set in Vietnam, right?
Right.
Like, I have sort of not super paid attention to Kristen Hannah. At least the U.S. cover looks coded for what we think about when we think about the Vietnam War. Like, you get the big tall palm trees and a helicopter flying over them, and that gives me Vietnam vibes. The UK cover looks beachy.
Well, there are beaches in Vietnam.
Well, yes.
I haven't read the women, but it does have more of a Polynesian Which, again, it looks a similar thing, but that was one of the things I found interesting.
It's more like a vacation book, is what.
Well, there's surfers on the cover. I'm not looking at it right now, but there's like surfboards on it. So I haven't read the book. I don't know. Readers can, or listeners can email us at podcast@bookriot.com. It's like, yeah, actually, surfing is a big part of it. That would be fascinating to know.
That would be fascinating. That would make me more interested. And like the US cover is that sort of ruby red that you were talking about in the jewel tones. The UK cover is a bright red. The title, The Women, is in bright yellow. And Kristen Hannah's name is in this like dark gray or black embossed text that isn't totally readable over the like some of the blue at the bottom of the cover. And so
and
that's
some of it's
interesting
the lighting and my camera and
the title is bigger than her name and is like a much bolder color. The font is a much bolder color than her name is. So I wonder if her name recognition is Kristen Hannah's curating lower in
the
UK?
That was another thing I hadn't thought about because I have no sense of what Hannah's profile is in the UK. I would, you know, just looking at the cover side by side, it suggests to me it's lower than in the United States. Hard to imagine it would be higher, but Kristen Hannah's name on the US cover is on top and it's larger than the title, which tends to tell you what you need to know. Mm-hmm. Plus, the UK version has this sticker that says from the author of The Nightingale with like a miniature cutout of the Nightingale cover on it, the little feather on it.
That's
so that,
cool.
That's a lot of, remember, you may have heard of this book, but not this author. Whereas I think the US version of The Women just says New York Times bestselling author. Like doesn't even have to reference The Nightingale anymore. It's like,
yeah,
that's fascinating.
It's like, we don't need to tell people who James Patterson is when his name shows up on a book cover anymore.
Yep. So I guess you're affirming the things I was interested in. And the last thing I was going to do is do a call out because I know we have booksellers here. Mm. Are we wrong or right to be flabbergasted as strong? Let's calm down here. This is a UK version.
A raised eyebrow.
But you and I have looked at, we have been in some bookstores and we talk about bookstores and we do this for a living. And it's rare I walk into a bookstore and see something I have never seen before. And I have generally never seen this before, so...
Yeah, a UK edition just sitting right there. And not just one, you said a bunch.
Yeah, well, there was two at least. Those are the only two I saw. I don't want to say more about the store because I really don't want to get someone in trouble that just because someone who hosts a podcast and runs a website happened to wander into your store with a damn camera, like suddenly you're putting you on blast. I really don't want to do that.
No, we're not out here for anybody to get in trouble.
And then the last thing, which I only came to later, is these are paperbacks. And I think I talked about this when I was giving a very, very layperson UK bookstore report from when I was in the UK last summer. The paperback first editions, like I know it's come for commercial romance here, but this is big. These are big time AAA mainstream titles, both in terms of prestige and sales, and they're paperbacks.
And you said it was $24, so not that much cheaper than the hardcover.
Not that much cheaper. Now, that I guess I didn't mention that, and I didn't spend the time to look and see what was printed on there, but this store had put little stickers on it with a handwritten price. So I don't know. I think they may have been charging some. They could have
been. They probably had to convert it from pounds.
Yeah, well, they had to, or they didn't, or they just did something else. Because yeah, there's not going to be a dollar price on there. But I didn't spend the time to say, wait, the pound says it's this, and if you convert to, a lot of the paperbacks I was seeing that were front list were £14, £15.
Okay.
So it's like 20%
Interesting.
If you add 20% to the dollar rate, you're getting pretty close. So. Sure, whatever, but it's not that much cheaper. I thought it was interesting. I'm not sure what else to say about it, but if you're affirming that this is dirty pool is too strong. If this is not what they should be doing, let me know that. If it's more common, boy, I guess I'd love to hear that too. If this is your store, I'm trying to be careful, but also I don't know what to say. I took some pictures. I'm talking about.
People with the internet in their pocket are in bookstores every day.
Yeah, I guess so. They don't all host podcasts, though, about it and put it on Facebook and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you don't have to be a podcast host to like have something accidentally go viral,
that's true.
Though. So.
That's true. But I was pretty interested in that.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And someone please tell me, is there surfing in this book?
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess that was going to be a segue into another thing I didn't have on the agenda, which is to look at... We haven't checked with sales in a while. And The Women is the number one best-selling book in the... Is it the country or just... Now, again, this is front list. I'm looking at Publishers Weekly, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. There could be, and probably are, TikTok books that are technically not front list anymore that are selling more. But the number one book in the country is The Scarlet Shedder, Dogman number 12. Shouts to Dave Pilkey.
Really just living it up over there.
And there are a bunch of Easter books. But if I put those to the side, The Women by Kristen Hannah is the number one best-selling book in the country. 44,000 units sold last week. Let's check in with some of our other things we've been tracing. Fourth Wing and Iron Flame are 2 and 3. 21,000, 18,000 copies. No surprises there. Number 5, James by Percival
Evans. That makes me so happy.
Almost 13,000 copies. A scant 5,000 copies behind Iron Flame. What a showing. Are we thrilled? Mm-hmm. Are you excited?
We are very good. I'm so thrilled. It's great. If we were saying F-bombs, I would be dropping them here. It is excellent. I had seen that James was selling well. I hadn't put it fully in context against, you know, Fourth Wing and Iron Flame, but like, holding your own against those for anybody is a big deal. But like, a literary work that is what James by Percival Everett is, for that to be selling so well, may it continue. Like, long may he reign. I want to see it on the best-selling books of the year come December.
I don't want to step too much on our Patreon episode, but I don't think that in this context it doesn't matter. We're really going to dive into the book there, but I can see why it's selling. It got a big push. Mm-hmm. The booksellers are pushing it. People are talking about it. And damned if it isn't fun to read this. Now, again, listen to the whole episode. It's about slavery. It is horrible. And all the slavery things are in there. And, not but, and there's pieces of it. There's an element to it that is just fun and fascinating. And
surprising.
Surprisingly page-turnery. So again, if you want to hear more about the flavors, the salt, fat, acid, heat that Percival is pulling off in this book, do the Patreon. But I can see this having legs for a while.
I hope so. And I think there's real paperback legs there like that. This talk about a book club dream. Like, there is so much to take apart in James. I cannot wait.
Like, I can see why Doubleday ponied up for it. It wasn't just whatever the next Percival Everett book was going to get a big thing. Like, this one, it makes a ton of sense.
Go ahead. Really want the story about is, how did they know it was time for him to go to a bigger publisher?
Or like, how did that happen? He's like, I got this James book, and like, well, this is the kind of thing we can sell a bajillion copies of. I think that's a great question.
Was this his agent being like, we can sell this to someone bigger? It's not quite as weird as what you normally do, or it's weird in slightly more accessible ways. Was it him? Was somebody sniffing around because they heard he was working on a retelling of Huck Finn, and a retelling of a classic is usually pretty saleable, even if it's not as good as James's. Right. Like, I have a lot of questions about how that happened. I'm so glad he landed somewhere that paid him big money and that had big budget to put behind that book, because it just deserves every last bit of it.
From where I sit, it did all three things I was hoping it could do. One is, it did Percival Everett things, which that's its own tributary. A lot of riparian metaphors, get ready. The second thing is, it was in conversation with Twain and Huck Finn in a way that was fascinating, subversive, and legible to people that maybe haven't read Huck Finn in a while.
Yeah.
And thirdly, it was stimulating, pleasurable, provocative on a page-by-page, sentence-by-sentence. It's all three of those things, which is magic.
Those are the things that I was looking for as well. And from page one, like, I had a mental model of what I thought a Percival Everett retelling of Huck Finn would be, and like, literally with the first sentence he turned that on its head. And I was like, oh, you're gonna, yeah, I thought I knew what you were doing here, bud, but like, surprising me about the direction this is gonna go and how you're gonna do it. And it stayed surprising. It's wonderful. We'll get into all the ways in which it's wonderful, but good job, Percival Everett.
Percival Everett knows what he's doing. Fascinating to see.
I'm just so glad that now everyone else knows that Percival Everett knows what he's doing.
Yes. Also, notable to check in, number 7, speaking of things with leg, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store. 10,000 copies, hardcover, sold last year.
Keep it going.
Top 10. House in Flame of Shadows, Sarah J. Maas. Underselling James McBride. fascinating to see.
I honestly, Jeff, I love to see it.
Well, listen, Moss has moved plenty of units. So
yeah, she's doing fine.
She's doing fine, but just where we are, I think that's fascinating. I'm seeing this book everywhere. I think it's a thriller. I don't really know. It's First Lie Wins by Ashley Elston. I think a lot of people like it's kind of taking up the mainstream thrillers plus people who are general readers, but will pick one of these up. It's a Viking Dorman title. I saw that everywhere. Okay. The Hunter by Tana French is in at number 12. I'm trying to think of what I think that's kind of the interesting things on the tide. So, you asked me specifically about The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. Is that his name?
Mm-hmm.
H-A-I-D-T. From Penguin Press. It's the number one hardcover front list seller this week. It's released this week, so we'll see what the legs are there. I'm seeing a lot. It's on the internet. People are talking about it, not surprisingly. Yeah. It's
props to his publicist.
Yeah, they're doing the things out there. The Wager, still at number top 10. 6,000 copies this week. I'm assuming Father's Day rolls around.
Paperback probably for Father's Day.
We're back up. I'm trying to think what else is notable here. Charles Duhigg, Super Communicators at 15 on hardcover front list, still kicking it. Trade paperback front list, Happy Place by Emily Henry. I mean, that's a whole year this thing has been moving.
Mm-hmm.
It's because I think we're coming back.
And the new one, I think, is... Yeah, new Emily Henry is out pretty soon, this month maybe.
This is a subject for a future episode, so I'm not going to get too much into it. But The Teacher by Freida McFadden is number 2, trade paperback front list. This is all over TikTok. That one I can tell you right now. Freida McFadden has 5 books on the trade paperback front list. This is our next Colleen Hoover. I don't know that it'll get to be as big as this, but it's picking up steam. She's got backlist out, and it is all over the place. So, you know, I'm not the first one to tell you, but we're not in the point where people are writing Freida McFadden stories, but they're going to be, because I'm just seeing it everywhere, and it's showing up in the sales here.
Can someone email me and tell me if those are better than Colleen Hoover books?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have no idea. Allie Hazelwood's Bride, number 6 trade. We talked about this. Allie Hazelwood writing her feminist fiction. She's writing a fantasy romance. I was also in Powell's the other day, and I did a quick Instagram reel of the top 10 best-selling science fiction fantasy books set to the final countdown. I was quite pleased with myself. I'm having a good time over there. And Bride was the number 5 best-selling book over there. Really matched up. Oh, that reminds us. Is this a question I asked you, or maybe I was asking Sharifa? I don't know. Is we're talking about adaptations. How is Dune doing?
Yes.
At Powell's, they had on the whiteboard that Dune was their number 1 best-selling book of March. So there you go.
Wow.
It is selling
great
titles. So that there, again, these are all, it wouldn't show up here because those are backlist.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, I guess that's kind of it for what's going on here. Anything interesting?
Stuff.
I don't know. I thought that was worth talking
about. Yeah, no, but we should, before we talk about anything else, we should remind folks, since you said The Wager, it reminded me of dad books. We got Moms, Dads, and Grads coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yes.
So if you want a recommendation from us for a mom, dad, or grad-like figure in your life or for yourself, for whatever reason, send us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. Patreon folks, you got a Google form a couple weeks ago that's still on the Patreon, because our Patreon members get priority on those requests. So if you're listening and you're on the Patreon, find that, put it into the Google form so we know it came from you. Everybody else, podcast@bookriot.com. Tell us what you're looking for, who you're shopping for, what's the vibe, and we will be back with those in early May. So.
Okay. Yeah, I think that is it. We've got some stories here. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to, then we're going to get into the rest of the news of the week.
Great.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman. The pressure cooker of minor league baseball leads to major chemistry in this exhilarating, sexy, and triumphant Rivals to Lovers debut romance. Gene Ionescu is the first openly trans player in professional baseball. He has nearly everything he's ever let himself dream of. That is, until Luis Estrada, Gene's former teammate and current rival, gets traded to the Beavers. Now, Gene and Louise can't manage a civil conversation off the field or a competent play on it, but in the close confines of dugout benches and roadie buses, they begrudgingly rediscover a comfortable rhythm. As the two grow closer, the tension between them turns electric and their chemistry spills past the confines of the stadium. So this is one of the first adult rom-coms published by a major publishing house centering a gay trans man by a gay trans man. It also has ADHD and anxiety representation and some joyful, heartfelt moments. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to The Dial Press, publishers of The Prospects by KT Hoffman, for sponsoring this episode.
Okay. I think some of this might show up in, this is off the script. I think a lot of this, I just got this yesterday. I haven't had time to digest it. An email mm-hmm. from a listener about behind the scenes things going at Barnes & Noble.
Oh.
And there's a request for anonymity, and there's a lot of really insider detail things here that I think are beyond the scope of what we normally talk about. But my sense is that the PR campaign Barnes & Noble has been doing for a while is, I think, working, but also it feels from the staff level. From this email, this is one person, but there again, mm-hmm. they're aggregating some other people's. I'll forward it to you later. I didn't do it before because I wasn't sure if we were going to get to it or what to say about it. But I'm interested if other people out there that are working at Barnes & Noble, or maybe you know someone who does, that wants to email us in with some experiences. I think our track record of keep people good is anonymous is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Affirmative consent is something we need. But stuff like shelf talkers cannot be more than 25 words. Like
what?
That level of stuff is what's in here. Stuff that was pretty surprising. Some stuff I don't understand about how many palettes they can they can. So lower perform stores being compared to other people in terms of lower performance, things to undermine influence or otherwise influence unionization's efforts. No, it's okay. We're going to keep the sneeze in. We did like a whole 5 minutes of pre-podcasting about how basically your life is inside of the stamen and pistil of a rhododendron.
Yeah, what did I say? My blood Allegra content is high. It's where we are right now.
If you were to drink Rebecca's blood, your sinuses would clear at this point. So I don't really know what to say. I thought it was fascinating. Again, it's a little beyond the purview of what we do here in terms of like, this might be a Wall Street Journal, New York Times kind of story, but someone who listens to the show, trusts us with us, what we know we have a platform here. I'm not exactly sure what else to say about it, except that all may not be peaches and cream with mm-hmm. the Barnes & Noble turnaround, at least from this one and maybe some people this particular bookseller knows. So thank you for writing into us.
Yeah.
I appreciate you doing that. And that's all I'm going to do with it right now. But I will call. I'd be interested to hear if there are more examples.
RIP to our future possibilities of being Barnes & Noble booksellers, because neither of us has ever summed anything up in 25 words or less.
I can't even sum up the story about not being able to sum up the shelf talker in 25 words.
Like, what's the, I have questions. What's the thinking there about the 25 word limit?
I guess just so that people
read
it. If it's super long, maybe people are turned off by it. I will quote this phrase, people are quitting in droves. So as if there's another story that comes out about retention and everything soon,
okay,
that will be interested to see. So there you go. All right. What story do you want to cover? There's a lot here. I bumped some stuff up that Sharif and I didn't get to. You put some stuff in. Where do you want to go?
We got to talk about this nugget about Meta that was in the New York Times piece about, so the New York Times had a piece earlier this week, a big, deeply reported piece by Cade Metz, Cecilia Kong, and Shira Frankel, who wrote a book about Facebook a couple of years ago that was excellent and like basically all the ways in which Facebook is bad, Stuart A. Thompson and Nico Grant. And the big gist of the piece is about the shortcuts that AI companies have taken to train their models. And by shortcuts, they mean like all the copyrighted material that they have accessed without permission, and that they're running out of it. And they might run out of it very soon. And the models are going to start training themselves on data that they have created. And that'll create like a hole in the space-time continuum or something. That's how that works, right? But buried in this piece is like a one-line mention that last year, when all of this was starting to come out about AI companies and tech companies needing data and using copyrighted material, leadership at Meta had a conversation, at least one, about maybe buying Simon and Schuster. And
just like, for the land rights. Sort of. Just so you could have the words to put into the machine.
Just to have access to all of the copyrighted material that Simon and Schuster owns. Now, how that would work specifically, and maybe this is part of the reason that they didn't pursue it, I don't know, because the authors still have the copyright. Simon and Schuster doesn't actually, like, the publisher doesn't own the copyright. The authors retain copyright.
That's probably why they didn't do it, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, oh, actually, so maybe you can't do that, right. Mark.
Maybe they realized it wouldn't have helped them any. But there was that window where the Department of Justice's case against the merger had succeeded and PRH was not allowed to buy Simon & Schuster, and a new buyer had not yet emerged, and Meta was apparently thinking about it. And this is really on my mind this week because Simon & Schuster just turned 100. They had a 100, like a centenary birthday party that the Times also covered. And I just couldn't help but think about the responses from the industry when KKR bought Simon & Schuster and the like doom and gloom predictions of like, this is the beginning of the end. And this private equity is evil. And then they're, and of course, because they're evil, they're going to run Simon & Schuster into the ground and saddle it with $1 billion of debt. And it's all just going to go to hell. And like, that's possible. Some private equity firms do that. And KKR has done it in the past, but it's not what they said they wanted to do with Simon & Schuster. And it's not what they have done. Simon & Schuster has grown, as the Times piece about its 100th anniversary mentioned. And it's notable that they have grown in the last year because sales have been up, but profits have been down basically everywhere else in publishing. So something is going right in what's happening at Simon & Schuster. And I was just having a really fun little like A-B test of the universe moment of like, if people had known when KKR bought Simon & Schuster that an alternative was that it could have been sold to Meta, would they have felt better about the KKR sale? Because like, the sky is falling in the like, just the level of sky is falling in the initial reactions to the KKR purchase was so high that it's hard for me to even imagine like how much worse they would have been if Zuckerberg had bought Simon & Schuster. That's all. I just needed to have a moment for like, this was a possible alternate future that none of us knew existed. And how does it shift our understanding of, you know, where Simon & Schuster did end up?
It's so fascinating to see. I mean, in reading through the piece, this idea of high quality text, published books and articles that aren't just the open internet, because Simon & Schuster's catalog is different than YouTube. I mean, that sounds silly to say, but it just is. But also the rapaciousness and voraciousness that these large language models have for text is truly mind-boggling. And not just text, right? They're doing podcasts, movie clips, other things right now, to the point that the level of input into the machines, the coal is being put into the engine so fast, very much on the Mississippi in a steamboat here, I guess, that they think these models could run out of new text to high quality text in like 18 months. Like, that's how
fast. It's wild.
It's just like not available. And this is the... this is probably, since the Yahoo, Google, Ask Jeeves search land grab, I think it's the phrase used in Halt and Catch Fire, this is the biggest one I've seen since then. Of the land grab is who can get this stuff into the model so that you have one of, if not the leading marketable AI model or an AI sort of basically base that you can spin out all kinds of stuff into. And it says in this piece, and I am not surprised at all, that when there's a gold rush, the law, expediency, good sense, even value gets thrown out the window. Because people get dollar signs. There's gold in them, their novels. And it's fascinating to see. And it's very much, I think the people that run these companies, they may say it to themselves in the dark night of the soul, or maybe they say it publicly in boardrooms, is we need to win this and we'll figure it out legally later when we get sued. That's clearly what they're doing, right?
Yeah.
And so that's one of the situations where the law is not going to keep up with them. And the stakes are so high for a Meta or a Google, I think specifically, that they're gambling that the rewards of breaking, bending the law or whatever the cost of that is going to be will be significantly outweighed by the riches they will earn for having done so.
Yes, that's right. And so, I think it's important for the book folks for us to hang a lantern on the fact that like they need access to all of the books to train these models.
Yes.
But the books are not their goal. Like,
no.
It may be a byproduct of the AI revolution. Maybe that something happens to the way books get made, or that somebody starts producing books that are written by AI. But the goals here are so much bigger. This is about like changing the way that the world works, changing the ways that industries function, changing the ways that like factories function and that things get built, getting us into space, like figuring out cancer, really big questions. And I find I think it's helpful and important to like continually reground myself in that like this is going to have impact in every industry. The book industry feels especially sensitive to it because we want good books and we want authors to continue getting paid and all of those things. But like Meta was never coming to like to just take over publishing.
To take over the mid-list novel space. Like, you know what? Let's get out our knife and fork and eat.
It is not their goal to take Kristen Hanna out of the game and then to sit back and be satisfied that they have succeeded in their mission. It's so much bigger than that. And in one way, I think like, you know, that might provide some insulation for the impacts of AI in publishing and for what folks are looking for from books. Like, nobody is sitting over at, you know, OpenAI being like, okay, now how do we put authors out of business?
It may be a byproduct. I mean, it's not unlike what Amazon did with books initially. It's like, this was the thin end of the wedge. This is someplace where we could get a foothold and make a difference. And it became it's probably now a rounding error, I'd imagine, the number of books, physical books they sell and the trillion-dollar behemoth that is
They are Amazon. Playing a much bigger game.
Yeah. And the law, I wish the law would catch up. I don't know what could be done to get injunctions or sue or whatever, because I do think if the game, if we are sort of, I don't know what else there is to be done. That's what law exists for.
Yeah.
To adjudicate what the fair use of this stuff really is, it needs to go faster, because the horse is out of the barn. The horse is out of the barn reading Reddit boards right now and memorizing.
Right.
Most of the stuff that's publicly available has been consumed. The next thing is, how do we do, like, I bet Google is still happy with itself for doing that like open source scanning project. Remember they did that?
Mm-hmm.
Now they've got all the things scanned in. Like,
yep.
The Bodleian Library is great, and there's a lot of books there, but all the stuff from 1811 has not been digitized. Like, you're going to have to have people. There's these super interesting videos of machines to scan books.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a laborious process. Even laborious just to make the machines and put them there so they can do them at scale forever. The text-based gold rush, you could knock me over the feather 10 years ago if you told me this. Meta would be thinking about buying Simon Schuster for billions of dollars just so they could scan all the crap in. I'm not trying to be pejorative. They would think of it as, I don't know, iron. They think of it as ore just to put into a machine.
Simon & Schuster went to KKR for like $1.6 billion, just
something
a little
like
over
that.
$1.6 billion. And the original deal with PRH was for $2.2 billion. And like, that is also pocket change. Meta.
Pocket change. Yeah, it really is. So I don't know. It's a good piece. It's worth looking at. And I would imagine if Macmillan or someone had if one of these houses had some kind of weird license where it could be read in a way that one of these AI LLM behemoths could argue reasonably that it's in the contract, they would buy one of them. They would. Mm-hmm. I think they would.
We also don't know that those conversations aren't happening.
We don't know that.
That could be happening. They could be working on licensing deals. You know, PRH would be the obvious target as the largest publisher in the country, with a huge backlist as well, you know, not just frontlist, but just a humongous back catalog. I don't know. I mean, Meta, I'm sure, could pony up the money, or, you know, OpenAI could raise the money to make an offer to a publishing company if that was the thing that they had to do. But it seems like unless or until the law catches up in a way where there are real consequences for them doing it the way they've been doing it without paying for any of it, why would you spend $1.6 billion or $2.2 or even more than that?
Meta had hired contractors in Africa to aggregate summaries of fiction and nonfiction. Which I guess is an interesting little hook to a story that I wanted to bring up from last week about the Amazon grab and go being basically a sham.
Oh my God. So satisfying.
I kind of wished it was like, yeah, we have this cool camera technology. We can do this. Whether or not it's a good idea is a second thing. But like,
right.
So the Amazon grab and go, we talked about these kinds of stores where I think there was a few in Seattle. I don't know where else they were, where you could go in, convenience-like store. You could put your milk and your eggs and your, you know, oat milk and whatever else you're getting into a basket and just walk out. And you get billed later. Well, it turns out what was actually happening is they had outsourced to a bunch of people in India who are watching videos and then manually, training the video so that it would eventually learn, but I don't know. I don't know if once you find out this, that's a sham.
Yeah. Right? It feels like three kids in a trench coat. Like, it's not groundbreaking technology. The thing that I thought about when I saw it was I listened to Christy Coulter's memoir Exit Interview last year, and she had been at Amazon for a very long time. Like, it was like 12 years, which is a really long time to spend at Amazon, maybe even longer than that. And one of the projects that she worked on was the like early version of these grab and go grocery stores. And she writes about it extensively and never mentions that this was how it actually worked. Also, of course, this is going to get out. Like, I think that was the moment that I eye rolled about. Was like, of course, someone is going to eventually tell this story that it's not magic. It's 100 people in a room watching videos. And like, I think you said it well, like even Amazon, which has made some legitimate technology magic, is not above some snake oil every now and then. It just gives us pause to like, the next time a thing sounds like magic, take a beat first.
And I do believe that the idea, and one of the reasons it doesn't exist anymore because it wasn't working, was that they were going to do it on the human scale to train these models. So they see enough times that this particular thing got labeled eggs. You see enough versions of that from enough angles, the machine eventually can pick up, oh yes, that's eggs, and not be tricked by it. And I think they didn't want to put that in there because no one wants to hear that. But I think that would have been, I don't know, I guess the truth I would prefer when people say like, oh, these in these early stages, what is happening if I'm doing this?
Treat me like an adult and tell me what the scam is.
Yeah. And say, you know, we're going to see if this works, and if it doesn't, great, if not, whatever. But like, I think it also then gives you a lot of bad faith for anything else you're going to do, right?
Yeah, because it's like the crime is not as bad as the cover up often.
And well, there's no crime here to say what's happening is we're training these models.
Yes, obviously, it's not a crime, but I'm just reaching for the expression that like it would have been fine. As you were saying, for them to be like, here's our new model, here's how it's going to get up and going. And there's a version of PR for that that's even like, if you're an early shopper at the Amazon grab and go, you're helping this new technology get developed. And there's somebody on the other side of it who's telling our computers, those are eggs, that's a banana, here's how much they each cost. Like, here's also why we're asking you to move about the store in such a particular way. That you could have, like, I think there's a version of that. People like, some people are really drawn to like new technology. I would have found that really interesting. And then to like let that be part of the public story of it when like, and now we're fully automated when that happens. Thanks to all of our early shoppers, like here we go. It just seems unnecessary to have kept it a secret. And so now that it was kept a secret and it's been revealed to be the thing that it was instead, it just makes it seem worse than it was. Like, obviously these things aren't perfect out of the box, and it makes sense that you might have to have some people involved in training your technology, but acting like it was magic when the magic didn't quite exist yet makes it seem like something like more sinister is going on, or you're trying to pull one over on consumers, and no one appreciates that.
Did I tell you this is, I probably didn't, but this is a barely orthogonal point. So I was driving around of late, and I don't use the tech in my car that much, but it was kind of a long drive, and it was, so I put on the adaptive cruise control and the lane change and whatever. So I keep my hand on the wheel, but we can listen to the audiobook. I'm paying attention, but I'm doing that thing. But I yawn. I'm 46-year-old, Rebecca, and I get up early, and I yawn. I do sometimes. I don't know what to tell you. I do yawn.
It happens.
It happens.
Yes.
And as soon as I yawn, my car told me to consider taking a break. So I think there was a camera pointed at my face, and someone had trained it
to
identify yawns.
You're not the boss of me.
Well, I appreciate the car, but like, yes, I know I'm tired. I've been this way for 12 years at this point. So,
yeah, I have got a much smarter car like 6 months ago, and I'm sure that I've yawned in it at this point, but it hasn't yelled at me. So
you might be too short.
To, like,
it might not be see your mouth behind the steering wheel.
I need to sit up on another phone.
Yeah,
book.
You got to sit up so you can get right up there. Take a look at the old gabber.
If you think that I'm not going to be sitting in my car yawning later this afternoon just to see if I can make it talk to me.
Well, that's, you know, I mean, I guess there's something else that it could be doing, but I don't know what it'll be doing. Like, I'm not blinking. I'm like, what else
yeah,
am I doing?
I know,
I'm not touching the steering wheel. I'm just sitting there driving.
Yeah, unless it was just a coincidence. Like, I've been in friends' cars that are just set, like, they come preset to tell you to take a break. I think it's every 2 hours. And it's just like, hey, you've been driving for 2 hours. Maybe you want to chill for a minute.
Yeah.
So unless you magically yawned at the 2 hours.
At the same, well, I think I did yawn again later and it popped it up again. So I was on the
okay.
lookout.
All
so
right.
I don't know if there's a real thing. I may be mistaking the person for three squirrels in a trench coat or vice versa, but I thought it was funny. I yawned twice.
Well, yes,
yeah,
some
to
of them. Don't some of them also, they have like heads up detection where like if it
they
looks
do.
Like you're nodding off, they can
yes.
catch that. So yeah, maybe yawning is part of
I think they should
it.
Add a little static electrical charge. You know, you got a heat warmer. if you get the yawn thing, a little zip.
Just a little zap.
Just a little zap, you know, like a AA battery's worth right in the butt.
Just, that'll wake you up. You combine it with the old Stanley Milgram psych experiment. There really is someone sitting on the other side, and it's like, do you want to give this guy a shock to wake
shock.
Him up?
I do not want to hook up my Kia Sorento to college students wanting to give me a shock. That's not happening. We can't do that.
Especially
okay.
when they find out you used to teach like Comp 101.
Yes, that's right. They're like, oh, this guy taught 8 a.m. Comp 101. All right. Yeah. Want to do a quick front list foyer before we start?
Yeah.
Off?
Let's
what
do some front list foyer. We got to talk about Hanif Abdurraqib, Jeff.
I know. You were crying on a plane? Is what you
said? I was. I didn't even think about the fact that he's from Columbus. The
oh.
book came out the Tuesday of the week I was going to Columbus. And so I was reading the Hanif Abdurraqib book, flying into Columbus. It's wonderful. So have you read it yet?
Nope. I'm going to listen to
okay.
it. I'm off audiobooks right now. It's a whole thing. Don't ask me.
Okay. So for folks not listening, it's called There's Always This Year. It's about ostensibly about basketball, but really about like everything. It's about community and identity and connection and race. And he's writing from the place of being just an avid basketball fan and also an avid player of like pickup basketball and community groups. And he lived in Ohio when LeBron was in high school, and like they would drive, you know, up to Cleveland to watch LeBron play in high school. He and his friends would, and then LeBron's playing for, you know, the NBA team, and he would go to games and sort of follow the whole thing. And it weaves in and out like his fandom of basketball in particular and LeBron in specific is really very minimal to really like a lot of reflection about the place of community and sports in his life. Like there's as only Hanif Abdurraqib can do, there's an essay that starts off being about his father and his father being bald, and also becomes about Michael Jordan being bald, but then is also about the hats, the like particular head coverings that he wore as a young Muslim man growing up, and then somehow is also about the frequency with which the basketballs they would play in his community were bald. Like they were old and well used.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I know those playground balls. Yeah, they're totally slick.
And,
yeah,
right. And it's just like, I mean, the dude is a poet, and it feels poetic in the way the book is constructed, because in one moment you're in an essay about like petty crimes that he committed when he was unhoused, and then somehow that same essay is also about like his connection to his grandmother and this like wider piece of the community that he grew up in. And near the end, the last couple of pieces get into interactions and encounters that he had with the police and the criminal justice system, and then watching Black men be killed at the hands of the police, and some of them like in his community in and around Columbus. And he's writing into that space like as my plane is landing in Columbus, and it's this love letter. The last couple essays are about like most people who make it in some fashion want to get out of the place they came from, or sometimes getting out of the place you came from is how you know that you have made it.
Yes.
And for him, he is so rooted in Columbus and in the community there that like he has made it, and he doesn't have to leave and doesn't ever want to not live there. And it becomes this like real love letter to the place. It was really moving, like, but it's a love letter to this city and also like a eulogy for the city and for the people of the city that have been killed in police violence. And I mean, all kinds, like I'm not going to be articulate about it, but it did. I was just like gently crying as a plane landed in Columbus. Like this was a gift from the universe to have that book happening at that time for me. But it was, it's so powerful. He's so wonderful. He's getting all of his flowers. There are big Hanif Abdurraqib profiles everywhere. And
Wyndham
I'm so
Campbell
thrilled.
Prize 175 large for our boy. He got that prize.
And like he's making good use of that MacArthur Genius Grant from a few years ago and the $1 million that came along with it. I could not be happier that he's getting this kind of recognition. I hope the book will be really, really widely read. It's just so gorgeous. And then I've also been reading my way through My Black Country by Alice Randall, which like also talk about a gift of timing. Alice Randall is a like legendary Black country songwriter and historian and professor. And she has a book about the Black roots of American country music that comes out 10 days after.
Trying to hit a bullet with a bullet.
Right. 10 days after Beyonce drops Cowboy Carter. And she's writing about like that whole history. American country music is Black music. There's no way to tell the story without talking about that. But American country music is also what Tressie McMillan Cottom calls like the last bastion of race music in the country. And it's white. And there's real tension there. And that's the tension that inspired the entire Cowboy Carter album. So if you are down a Cowboy Carter rabbit hole, which I am deeply down right now, you don't want to miss Black Country, because it's part memoir and part history, where Randall is telling her own story through the lens of her experiences with some of the early Black country musicians, and then also research that she's done. You can build yourself a hell of a playlist of the folks that she recommends, and many of the more contemporary Black country and Americana artists that she talks about also appear on Cowboy Carter. So it's wonderful. Like what, it's really, really fascinating. It's just a cool time, I think, for media and for entertainment media to be talking about like the real history of American music and to have platforms for folks to explore and be exposed to it. It's very cool. So those are my front list moments. Where have you been?
Let's see. Well, I read James over the last couple of days, so you're going to hear more about that. I bought The Cemetery of Untold Stories from an independent bookstore, the Julia Alvarez I talked about before. I'm really excited to do that. It's also, I have to admit, when I'm buying a physical book, like looking at these books that are like $250 to $320, they just feel more approachable. This one's like $240. It's like I can pick it up, like I can read that in the afternoon if I really get moving on that. A little bit of stuff that's not even front list. It's coming out soon. The Strange Eventful History by Claire Massoud.
Oh, yeah.
Stay tuned for relevant content coming to a associated podcast near you, similar for The Unsettled by Anna Mathis and The Real Americans by Rachel Kong, which I just got into this morning.
Oh, I can't wait to start
relatively
that one.
Soon. Starts out in New York in 1999, people soon to graduate college. So very close to home for me. yeah. I know this world well. All right, not the world they're in, but that New York of immediately before September 11th, and then, of course, the years that after. I'm very interested. The Strange Eventful History, really fascinating. Big book, multi-perspective over time. It feels like a little bit of an old school kind of work. I haven't seen Masood do this before. I've not read all of her. I will say this, too, that it has one of the more... Some books you're ready, I guess, or you're somehow prepared for there to be an end that is surprising or alters the landscape of the book you just read. I did not get that sense from this. And the end of this, it feels like that this book may have been written for like the last 15 pages that are germane and not. Anyway, it was pretty fascinating to see, but it's beautiful historical fiction. Like, and you're really going to delve into it. There's long paragraphs and long sentences with many subordinate commas and clauses and descriptions. Like, it's very, very, I don't know, writerly in that regard, where some of the pleasure of the book, and maybe the pleasure and purpose of writing it, is to get to describe these places and scenes and characters. I think one thing Masood is especially good at here is all of the perspectives. Like, she doesn't do the thing where like the style is wildly different for each character, but she does such a good job of representing their interiority and point of view and perspective on what's happening, that it really feels multimodal in a way that sometimes it doesn't feel that way. Some, like, you're from this character's point of view, but it's more of an exposition canon than it is actual perspective. I guess it's more World War II historical fiction than I was expecting, but it's also not directly. Like, it's, I don't know, what is it? These Greek islands and then these other Mediterranean countries that are around, but then it's about French Algiers and Jewish people kind of at the margins of the war. And then what happens in the long history. Anyway, pretty fascinating to see. I don't know that's going to sell a billion copies, but for a certain kind of upmarket to into literary reader who likes historical fiction, it has an English patient-y vibe to it.
Oh, so
I appreciate
well,
that.
Well, say no more.
I don't think it had, if anything, it might be, I don't think it's directly commenting on it, but it's also, it's aware of these historical epics, right?
Okay.
And it's trying to do something a little bit different, I think. So that's very cool. And then Unsettled, you'll hear me talk about that on a different show, so I'm not getting too much into it there.
Cool.
All right. So James, coming up, sign up for the Patreon. Any other longer lead time stuff, people? I'm not looking at it right now. What else?
Oh, yeah. Let me take a look for a longer
dad's grads,
lead time.
Do those. Email
Yes. Yeah. Send us your moms, dads, and grads. We have the summer draft coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I got to get ready
for
that.
So just keep an eye out for the summer draft. And then at the end of May, we will be celebrating the 35th anniversary of Ishiguro's Remains of the Day. So we're going to reread, talk about a book that will satisfy your desire for low page count. We're going to reread the Remains of the Day, watch the film, and talk about that on the Patreon. So if you want to join us for an Ishiguro love fest for maybe our collective favorite author,
great question. It's up there.
Or top of the list of many, many lists that we have made. He's been atop them. That'll be happening at the end of May.
Did I ever tell you that I almost named Reading 8 my old blog Remainders of the Day? That was like my second choice for a title.
I have not. That is one O'Neill story I had not heard before. Yeah, that's great.
I don't have many left in the tank, but there you go.
I know. We know each other's material at this point. Yep.
All right. Podcast at bookriot.com, bookriot.com/listen. Link in those show notes for everything we talked about there. Go look at the covers if you want. I'll put the James ones up too at some point. Not in the show notes, but on the Patreon. So maybe I'll hold that into the newsletter. That's a good use of the newsletter.
Oh, perfect. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I also texted you with a book that I did not buy, but I almost did. Speaking of Ishiguro, a signed first edition of Claire and the Sun. So if you're curious about what that goes for,
I was going to ask.
Did I not show you the reverse?
No.
Okay, well, you have to find out with everybody else.
All right.
Thanks, everybody.
I'll be waiting.